Welcome to all of our listeners out there. We're talking tonight to Janet Kuipers, the author of many different poetry books and the new novel, The Key to Believing, about AIDS and a government conspiracy. If you could just tell us even more than I've told all of our listeners about all of the different literary experiences that you do and create, that would be wonderful.
I've written poetry for probably over 20 years, and I've probably got 4 or 5 books of poetry published starting in 1993. I run a website for Scars Publications. I think that's on your site, http blah, 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 scars.tv. And they've got everything from information about the magazine that I run there, Children, Churches, and Daddies, as well as downloadable chat books. There are PDF files. There's a news and philosophy text archive. We've got sound files for the audio and video section, all sorts of really cool stuff there. Primarily right now, what I'm doing a lot of is performance art, as well as trying to get my work out to people, setting up shows with not only poetry, because that's what they want to hear usually, is journals and short stories as well, and setting them up with images in a display and music in the background, because I'm a photographer and do music work in my spare time.
On our website, the Artists First Network, we have displayed Janet Kuipers' 2 website addresses, which you can check out, www.janetkuypers.com and www.scars.tv. And right now we're going to play one of Janet's performances off of one of her CDs.
Is this I'm trying to remember the piece. Is it Fantastic? I'm trying to remember. Is it Fantastic Car Crash?
Yes.
I actually, this is a good piece of irony about this. I wrote this poem, and it happened to be 3 days before I almost died in a car accident. Somebody tried
to...
Wow. And this was written 3 days beforehand about someone else in a car accident. So, a good prelude to the piece, I guess.
Deja vu.
And our life is one big road trip now. And we set the cruise control and make our way down the expressway. And most of the time we're just moving in a straight line and the scenery blurs. There's nothing to see. But I know what's inside you and I know what you're made of. I know there's no such thing as a calm with you. You are a fantastic car crash. You stop traffic into both directions as the gapers gawk and the delay grows and they slow down and stare. Everything shatters with you, you know. It's a spectacular explosion. I try to duck and cover as metal flies through the air. And every time you leave the scene of the accident, I am left picking up the shards of glass from the windows. You know, the glass breaks into such tiny little pieces. They look like ice. It takes so long to pick up the pieces, and even though I'm careful, I'm still picking up the pieces, and I'm still on my knees. And the glass cuts into my hands, and the blood drips down to the street. Think of it as my contribution to this fantastic car crash that is you, that is me, that is us, as I pull the glass from my hand. And I wave my hand to the line of traffic. Go ahead. Keep driving. This happens all the time. There's nothing to see here.
You've told me that many times your poetry and other writing just flows out of your personal experiences, and yet this one was written before your actual car crash.
Correct. So you want to know why? I use the idea of having a car crash as being a metaphor about how the person that I was writing this about, going through a car accident, and I was just on the sidelines, everything can happen around them, and I end up cleaning up the mess and figuring out what to do and make sure things happen and work out for you, and I suffer somehow in the process as well. But you're the one that goes through it all the time. Mm-hmm. I'm always sitting there by your side, and I get to see it all, but it's usually not me that's in the accident. So, and they said, isn't that a delicious irony that 3 days later I almost die in a car accident?
Wow.
So, yeah. So, that was a delicious irony piece, yeah.
The next one we'd like to play is her piece called He Told Me His Dreams. Do you have anything you'd like to say before we play this?
I usually get ideas from people from, you know, in what inspires you to write, that kind of thing. Mm-hmm. I get a lot of ideas from submissions that I get as the editor of the literary magazine I work for. I see other people's writings, and I come up with ideas from that.
Uh-huh.
And I saw people doing things about a series of poems about something, and I was around someone, and they were talking about dreams they were having, so I just did a series of 9 or 10 pieces about their dreams. And later I asked this person if they would read back and forth with me some of these pieces, and I believe that is what you've got there, and He Told Me His Dreams.
Yes.
He was walking by the way and entered on 60th Green. And they turned around the corner in their car, opened fire on him. He was hit over and over again. His teeth were shattered by bullets. He said he died then, and he saw from up above his bloody body. He even saw his obituary. But then he went back. He did it over again. This time, he was in the doctor's office. It's always like this,
he thinks.
Always running away from death.
Always. Running away from death.
Still sounded incredibly dreamlike and all. Many times my friends have also told me their weird dreams. It's like they have to get it out and share it with someone. That particular one related to death.
Most of the pieces often did from that one person. They would talk about it. They had a lot of death pieces that they saw themselves dying, or occasionally they'd have something about the teeth falling out. I think I had another piece, and they said, what does that mean if you have a dream that your teeth are falling out? And I said, I think it means you're pregnant, because I've heard that from women. He's like, no, shut up. But the person had a lot of strange dreams like that about dying or being chased by people wanting to kill them, and so I decided that it would be good to put them down, just have some sort of recording of these things.
This being the second anniversary of the September 11th tragedy, it's interesting. And Janet would like to have another one of her pieces played as a tribute. It's called Death Takes Many Forms, and she'll explain a little bit about that particular piece as well.
This is about someone that I was good friends with and later dated, and they ended up dying while I was traveling, and I wasn't able to say goodbye to them, and that's one of the hardest things to go through when you don't expect anything to go wrong, suddenly something does. And I think people in New York know exactly what I'm talking about right now. This experience is not the exact same thing, but it's the whole idea of thinking that everything's fine and normal and trying to help someone through and then having them disappear on you without a trace.
Definitely.
And this is about Dave, and sorry, Dave, you're up there. Sorry. My credit to him.
It is winter now. The trees have lost their leaves. The city is covered in a thin layer of soot and snow. The grass is dead. In the sunless sky, black birds circle overhead, searching for prey. An eerie cold settles over everything. Nothing is growing anymore. Death takes many forms. For you, death first came when you were 5 years old and your mother had give you 3 shots of insulin a day until you could take a needle to yourself. Did it hurt you to push that needle into your arm the first time? Or did it hurt you more to know you had no choice? Death takes many forms. Death can be someone telling you without trying that they are losing their sight. Behind Coke bottle glasses, you would see me and say, "That's a nice black suit you're wearing." And I would tell you, "It's green." And you wouldn't believe me. You wouldn't hear the howling wind of the changing seasons. Death takes many forms. I know what follows the autumn wind. It is winter now. Do you remember when it happened? The changes are subtle. The temperature drops, first only slightly. It's almost imperceptible. Only when the first snow falls do you realize where the seasons have gone. Death takes many forms. Death can be a sweat-soaked shirt, the shakes, dizziness when you needed food. You would look as pale as a ghost as I would hold your cold, wet arm and study you. Quick, some sugar will make everything better. Isn't everything better yet? Death takes many forms. The signs of death can come when you first lose your circulation. "My feet are numb, Janet," you'd say. "I can't feel my feet anymore." And I would rub your feet for you. And you would say it makes a difference. You feel better. If only I could do this forever. Death takes many forms. I said goodbye to you to travel my own road, but I didn't think it was the last goodbye. How was I to know? Are you trying to teach me a lesson? Because if you are, well, I've learned it. Trust me, I have. You can come back now. Death takes many forms, and now it seems you've taken me down with you. You've taken me into that casket with you, and I'm running my hand along your jacket lapel, and I can feel the coldness of winter all around me, and I can hear them shoveling the dirt over my head, and I want to get out, and I want to take you with me. Death takes many forms. Death can be that hole you left, you know, right over here, just a little to the left. I keep wondering when the pain will go away, when everything will be better. You once showed me that winter could be beautiful. Instead of the dark and dirty snow lacing the city streets, you showed me a quieting snowfall over a lake at your parents' backyard, glistening in an untouched whiteness. I told you I hated winters, and you told me, "This you don't hate." Well, I'm still learning. It is winter now, and death takes many forms. The seasons change for you and I. It is snowing, and something is ending. It is snowing. Somewhere, it is snowing.
Janet is going to tell us a little bit more about that piece.
It was such a traumatic thing for me to go through as an innocent bystander, and not able to do anything and just seeing all of this destruction happen, that I didn't know how else to be able to get out my feelings and get them across without sounding, you know, over-exaggeratedly obnoxious. And so I ended up writing that piece down, which probably explains why I write so much, because I don't think people want to hear it so often, so I'll put it down to paper.
Can you tell us the titles of all the books that you've collected your writings into?
The first book was published in 1993. It is called Hope Chest in the Attic. because of all those ideas and things you want to store up. It collects 13 years of poetry and prose and art from me. The second one is called The Window, and that one has a lot of pieces that are parts of series, like the poem He Told Me His Dreams, which you played, was in the book The Window, because they're just stories from other people from a long story line of what other people will tell you. The third book I did probably has the best title of them all. It's called Close Cover Before Striking.
I like that one too.
It's a fun title. I like that one. And it contains, and it has, you know, the byline says a book of poetry, prose, political essays, artwork, and philosophical rants. So I get to delve more into having essays and philosophy in my work instead of just having lists of poetry out.
Mm-hmm.
I did a very short novel in letter form under a pen name called Autumn Reason. And I also did a spiral bound book all about the clash between the sexes, because I long ago had done work as an acquaintance rape workshop facilitator and got to hear people's stories about dealing with rape, from people, stories they'd heard, as well as, you know, things that have happened to them. So I have a book called Woman, which has a bunch of pieces, some never published, a lot of short stories. And the last or more recent widespread book of poetry is called Contents Under Pressure, and that one also has quite a few short stories and a lot of political pieces and essays in it, probably more than any of the other books. I've done a few small printing runs on another woman's book called The Average Guy's Guide to Feminism. And I also did one about after traveling around the United States by car with a friend called Changing Cures. And it was a bunch of journal entries and stories about going from state to state and what you saw and what bizarre experiences you go through in meeting new people and finding a place to stay. Those are most of them, other than the big, huge, most recent novel, which is a 650-page opus called The Key to Believing. It's a private printing, which is what we've done right now for it, dealing with, working with agents right now to be able to get it trimmed down so it's right for dealing with the publisher. But that piece is about medical researchers that are looking for a cure or medicines for AIDS patients, and one of them stumbles upon information that leads them to believe that there is a government conspiracy about the origin and possibly also possessing a cure for AIDS. So it then also becomes it always started off with a very intelligent bent and learning more about the disease, but it also then becomes much more action-packed about trying to figure out how to be able to save lives, save their own lives when they've just gotten these information from agents and the like. And that's a fun, long one, if anybody's interested.
Now, I, Jade Logan, have read this book, and she did keep my interest all the way to the end.
All those pages?
Yes. Now, I have a bad habit when I'm a little bit, when I find something not quite interesting, I skip over it. So I'm glad you're going to an agent, but I did read all the way to the end. I didn't skip any large portions like I have in other people's books.
Well, that's good to hear. Thanks. I know there's a lot of details and information in there, so there's a lot that goes on within the story. I mean, learning about things for the disease and how to live a healthier life is mm-hmm. one thing. Learning about, you know, the fictional aspect of the government angle on having a cure or learning about the creation of AIDS is another one altogether.
The main character in the book is a researcher who's researching into AIDS, drugs that help people that have AIDS, and she finds in the story, finds out that the CIA? Some part of the American government had actually supposedly created AIDS and had an instantaneous cure for it.
Because they had the base components of the virus to begin with, they were able to create a cure for it. Yeah, that's the story. That's the story behind it. And then she has to figure out whether or not that's actually the truth or not, because she's only getting bits and pieces of evidence, and she is a researcher. She deals with science, and she's trying to grapple and learn more about what's going on than people who tell her these stories or these things she gets information from. She finds out, they died. or something happened to them, and suddenly she's like, why are they, what's happening? And then she tries to start getting more pieces together to be able to see if there's any truth to the story. And then again, she tries to see if there's anything that she can do to actually fight the all-powerful government to be able to help people out at all.
Definitely a mystery, thriller, and conspiracy theory type book all wrapped into one.
Yeah, I don't know what you got. I mean, like, is it a mystery? Well, there's mystery to it, but yeah, there's so much in it. So, it's also got quite a lot of philosophy stuff in it because I think the main characters possess qualities that you probably don't often see or read or hear about. I know in the beginning of the book she's ripping on the idea of religion, and she's got people that work with her that are, you know, devout Catholics, and they're going, why are you doing this? And she's just being cocky, it seems. But it seems that with her, and not saying that there's anything wrong with other religions or faiths, but that she was able to figure out, using as much science as she could to figure out what, you know, to find out what she could, that those things worked for her as well. That also gave her an additional kind of drive that people don't often anticipate non-religious types to experience.
Mm-hmm. Back to your entire writing career, I understand you you told us at the beginning that you help publish work
with
Scars.
Yes, I do publishing work, and I do design work for Scars Publications, and I run the literary magazine. I get to design their books as well for Scars. But anybody that has books done, that gets to be my job. I make gorgeous books for them. So, yeah.
How do you do that?
How do I do it?
Yes.
Well, you learn how to design them. I mean, that was my specialty. My previous jobs were as an art director for publishing companies. And I think years and years and years ago, I wanted to be able to get published. And I saw that you're an unknown. Nobody knows anything about you. We're not going to consider you. I think one place, poetry.com, or they'll accept your work. And they say, yeah, we'll publish a book for you. It'll cost you $10,000.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, and I thought, that's not right. And I was just looking at it going, if I wanted to, I could publish a book for a heck of a lot less, and I could have more copies and have complete control over, you know, mm-hmm. but, you know, how it will look and what exactly will be in it and that kind of thing. So I started learning about different kinds of printers as well, helpful in the fact that you're also an art designer and you know how to design stuff in the first place.
In your work with a literary magazine, and does that flow into your performance art?
Sometimes it does, yes. What I found really funny is that after I had that accident that I talked to you about, it had been a few years before, and then I got back into the poetry scene, quote-unquote, in Chicago, where I live. Someone recognized me because I had done a show with them 4 years ago, and they said, hey, you're on the scene, you should do a show. And I thought, wow, I almost died. I haven't been anywhere. You want me to do a show? Okay. So I'm like, quick, come up with something for a show. And they said they wanted you to do a show of poetry because they do weekly poetry shows. And so I thought, okay, I have to make this more interesting somehow. So I interspersed short stories and journal entries, and I talk to people about ideas, and then it would flow into something that could become a poem. And so I set up this 45-minute long show or whatever, mm-hmm. bunch of images, because I used to be a photographer, so I have a lot of artwork. So I would have images going according to whatever I was reading or saying, and then I would have music in the background as well. So I would just be a sitting person with a computer set up and trying to have this whole show set up. So it has become that. And I think after that, it's like, okay, you're going to be a regular now. So I do quarterly performance art shows through them. My next show with them is in October 22nd at the Cafe in Chicago. And actually, because people recognize me as being the editor of a literary magazine as well, they say, oh, we've got things going on. You should be elected, you know, performance artist of the evening. And there is a reading tomorrow at DVA Art Galleries in Chicago. And I'm the featured performance artist. It starts at 8 o'clock. If you bother, I guess, at the websites, I can give you information as to where DVA Galleries is. But I'll have a small show of assorted pieces with music and images as well. So, yeah, being an editor, people recognize you and think, oh, you should do this, and you will do, you know, which is mm-hmm. helpful, which is very helpful, because if I'm not in the middle of running around to do shows and be seen everywhere in Chicago, people will recognize me because I do things other than just, you know, sitting at open mics and reading my work every week somewhere.
Could you tell us a bit about your literary magazine, Children, Churches, and Daddies?
It sounds like a religious title. It's not, I swear. The title of the magazine is named after a poem that talks about the dysfunctionality of being a child, dealing with dysfunctional fathers and having to go to church if you don't know if you believe in it and that kind of thing, mm-hmm. and seeing the dysfunctionality of that. So the magazine usually doesn't go for writing work or religious work that screams religious work. I think people who don't know anything about the magazine will send a submission to me without getting guidelines or anything that will start with, "Dear Janet Kuipers, hi, I'm a Christian mother of four, and I have these rhyming pieces about the love of Jesus that I want to send to you." And I'm just looking at this cover letter, and I'm thinking, I get this sinking feeling that I'm not going to want anything from this, because a lot of times what you want from poetry is an emotion that you can't often get from rhyming pieces, because you're worried too much about making one line, what the end of one line work and rhyme with the end of the next lines. So Children, Churches, and Daddies has been around for just over 10 years. It started in June of 93, and it's amazing the kind of people, you know, that'll send snail mail submissions as well as email submissions. If you go to either one of the websites that are on artistverse.com, you can find the links for scars.tv or janetkuipers.com and learn more about it and send work if you're interested. Or you could see past issues or what other accepted writers have published as well, because we have listings of that too.
Do you have specific examples? Do you usually include things like philosophical essays or...
Do we include that?
Or what sort of items?
Chance, but seldom do people submit them, which uh-huh. we would love. We found that in the past year or so, people are sending more and more short stories as well, and that is a thrill for me, because I've got something other than, you know, 20 lines of somebody talking about being in bed with somebody, which is half of the poems I think I get. But it's quite refreshing, even if they're horror pieces, which I believe accepted for publication every once in a while, one of those. We have a relatively open, you know, idea of what we're looking for. If people are interested in posting essays, we recently posted an essay for CC&D magazine. It's much to say than Children, Churches, and Daddies. The expanded version of CC&D has a news section, which will pull news articles and press releases from, and we also have a section in the back called Philosophy Monthly. If we have no relevant pieces to worry about right at that time, we might pull something from Physics by Aristotle, or something that we can pull in for, you know, essays that people wrote for the Ayn Rand Institute or something, so we'll have something from some organization. But we'll have pieces from others as well that talk about opinions on political issues that are more than just newsworthy. They're often more opinionated. They're mm-hmm. philosophical rants, like I have in one of my books. So, yeah.
Do you have any poems that you'd like to read?
Oh, my gosh. I can think of the first poem I ever read in public, but I don't know. How about this will be funny. See if I can remember. The first poem I ever wrote, I was 9 years old, and I was doing this for class, and it rhymes. It's one of the few ones I've got that rhymes. And I had so much help from my mother on this one, because I didn't even know what a manatee was. I was 9. Give me a break. But I have this rhyming piece. Let's see if I can write. It's called Under the Sea. I'd like to be under the sea to watch the fish go swim. I'd like to squish a jellyfish and then let go of him. I'd like to grab a soft-shelled crab and take him for a walk. I'd like to hurdle over a turtle and teach dolphins to talk. I'd like to see a manatee and then go play by him. I'd like to do all of these things. If only I could swim. There's the piece. And I could swim. So, yeah. Well, how was that for you?
That was good.
Thank you. Thank my mother. I didn't, as I said, I don't even know what all that, a manatee. Okay. That'll work.
In the book that you sent me, Hope Chest in the Attic, I noticed you have a couple of pieces about your mother. Now, at the beginning of this, you did say that some of the items mixed fiction and...
Oh, yeah. And that's what I'd usually say about most everything. That I mean, usually also if you're going to write something down, even if it comes from something that you've understood or experienced or lived through, your own interpretation of it will... to other people, if they know it or live it, might seem fictitious. So I would say that even if there are elements of truth, well, there are usually always elements of truth in something, but there will also always be something to make it stronger, which might be a bit of fiction to make it more full of a story.
Would you like to read any of those, or are you able to?
From that first book? I'd have to look for something. I can think of something that's in Close Cover Before Striking, because this is the first piece I ever read at an open mic, which was hard to do. I think that was like in 95. And I go to a place, and this place had just started, and I think there were four of us there, and we didn't have a microphone. We sat around a table, and I think we were all just drinking water. I think they hated us at first. I did this piece. I wonder if I can find it in case I forget it. And you'd also have to know about me that, well, you don't know me now. I've got brown hair, but I used to dye my hair, so I was a blonde way back in the day. And so that was where the beginning of this piece came from, and it's called Too Far. When he met me, he told me I look like Kim Basinger, long blonde locks. But as time wore on, I knew I wasn't her, and I could never be her, and I was never good enough, thin enough, pretty enough. So I got a perm, I straightened my teeth, I bought the Wonder Bra, but it wasn't doing the trick. So I bought Slim Fast, I used a stair stepper, I ate rice cakes and wheat germ, but I wasn't thin enough, I only dropped 20 pounds. So I went to the spa. I got my skin peeled, I soaked myself in mud, wrapped myself in cellophane, bought the amino acid facial creams, but I knew they didn't really work. So I went to the doctor, I got my nose slimmed, my tummy stapled, my thighs sucked. I thought about getting a rib or two removed, you know, like Cher. But I figured they've got to be there for something. And hey, that's just going too far.
Wow. That sounds painful.
So that was the first one I ever read in public.
Uh-huh.
I didn't know what to read, so.
Definitely a good one to get a reaction.
Yeah, and oftentimes people will have poems and they'll be like, this is a poem about... the girl that left me, you know, or some sorrow of love. And I was like, well, let's get something with a little different kind of bent, but, you know, the same idea. Something that at least some of the crowd can get a kick out of.
Yeah.
Yeah. I haven't had my tummy stapled.
Well, that's good. How many poems have you written over the years?
Oh, my gosh. Over 1,000, probably over 1,100, I'd have to guess. I don't know for sure, but yeah, a lot. Many, many poems. I've done short stories probably toward 50. Very few articles. I've had essays, 10 to 20 of those. But I've also done a lot of artwork because I was a portrait photographer for a few years back in the early 90s. And I love the camera because that is a beautiful way to be able to capture things. And then working on the computer as well, you can be able to morph and create new images out of them. So I've had artwork published probably around 1,900 times online or in magazines, books, and that kind of thing.
That's incredible. I'd like to tell our listeners that the artwork on the covers of Janet Kuiper's books and inside at the beginnings of chapters and all. She has created herself.
They're mine, yeah. Yeah, the only one that I can't say that I took the photographs for was the cover of The Key to Believing. I use stock photography of a gun and an AIDS ribbon and a key. Ergo, The Key to Believing. But I just manipulated them to make them work for the cover. But yes, I'm usually taking my pictures and creating. Sometimes you don't know exactly what you're looking for, so you're like, well, what the? I'll just go out and get it myself. And so you go on a search.
And I'd also like to remind everyone that you can buy her books through the two websites, JanetKuipers.com and Scars.tv, our website has links to.
The poetry books, there are links for PayPal if you want to just be able to purchase a copy and order it that way. Or you can let us know, I can send a check off. The Key to Believing, because it's still working with editors, I've got a private stash of my own full copy of the book, which will probably be rare once it actually is put out on bookshelves. But if people want a copy of that, if I've got copies around, you're more than welcome to contact me about it. That would be great. Yeah, and all the chapters in between the chapters for The Key to Believing have generic images, and those were from portraits and things that I had done of other people. That was something I didn't know if you had noted or mentioned, but there's 21 chapters in this long book, and there are images or ones that I had created throughout the book as well.
Now, you wrote and told us that you don't actually have writer's block. Would you like to tell everyone how your writing process usually goes?
Well, I don't think I have writer's block because I usually only write when I think of something worthy of writing about. So I don't write daily and constantly about something. The only time I've had something with a deadline was with this most recent book, The Key to Believing, and I had made a decision that I was going to work on it, and I had traveled and traveled across the country to go to my parents' house, and I knew no one there, and I thought, okay, I can start working on this novel while I'm there, and because I had nothing in front of me, I ended up working on that book hours every day, and sometimes I would be able to, I'm like, oh, went through a chapter, and I know it had to be edited, but I'd go through 30 pages in a day because I had written an outline to begin with, so I knew where I was going with what I wanted to write. Sometimes I'd have to go through a really, really, really hard scene where somebody's, you know, dive rolling with a gun and something that I don't usually do, like action scenes like this. And I'm like, oh, I just worked through 6 pages today. And that was all I was able to do because I couldn't figure out how to get it down. But actually, while I was there for this 2-week period, I had said I wanted to start working on the book. I actually finished it there. I was just writing so much because I had an idea of what I wanted, and I would come up with an outline and would come up with details of that. Before I had sunk into writing this novel, I would sit around in the evenings and take time and think about what would this main character do, and I would try to start to feel like I was in her shoes and what things is she facing and what will she have to go through. And that helped me, I think, a little in being able to later write these things down and come up with these ideas. With poetry and short stories, I don't go through a matter of writer's block because I'll only write if I feel like it. I mean, if I don't feel like it, I don't call that writer's block because I'm not driven to write a short story or a poem. I'll just be like, I don't feel like doing it, so I'll just put that on hold until I feel like it, and then I'll be able to just let it all out. With writing a poem, and oftentimes writing a short story as well, but with writing a poem, that usually often comes off of my own experiences. If I go through something or if I see or I feel something that happened to someone else or even to myself, I need to get it out of my system. So I try to think of a way to put it into words, because if I can do that, that way will help me to process the bad experiences or, you know, events that I've seen or gone through in my own life, and it'll help me get it out of my system then at the time. Becomes therapeutic.
Is that why you frequently write about women's issues and why you studied them in college?
I studied that, and that was a surprising thing. I think my family really worried because they thought, oh my God, what's happened to her? But I had studied because I have stories about rape education and that kind of thing, and I would say no, that didn't happen to me, but that's irrelevant because people seeing, you know, whether or not it happened to me wasn't the issue. But the thing was, I decided that I wanted to get into this because I saw, if nothing else, the fact that women were treated differently from men, even ones that were hardworking and driven and were oftentimes better than half the men that they dealt with. They still had to deal with this obstacle of men, you know, looking down at your breasts instead of actually thinking about the brain in your head. So I decided that I wanted to be able to see what I could do to help women that are going through experiences that a lot of people think might be you know, not a big deal or commonplace. I learned, well, if they are commonplace, I learned that most women that go through college will be, 1 in 4 will be raped. Not by a stranger all the time, but by an acquaintance. Could be a boyfriend, somebody that they'd broken up with, or somebody they'd gone on dates with, or a buddy that they knew and felt comfortable enough with to bring them back to their own dorm or whatever. The statistics further say 1 in 3 women in the course of their lifetime will be raped. And that's a scary statistic because if you know enough women, you've got a family with 3 sisters and a mother, you know, if nothing's happened to them, they might have dealt with this same kind of pressure somehow, even if they haven't gone through a rape. And I would see these things. And because people knew I was an acquaintance rape workshop facilitator and I did performances and things about pornography for against women and that kind of thing, people would come up to me and tell me about how they'd been raped. And that gets a little tech. I mean, there's nothing wrong with people telling me their stories at all, but at the same time, it starts to wear at you a little too because there's nothing you can do, and all you're doing is hearing all of these bad stories over and over again. So trying to get them out of your system, it often helps to write. I think I have Rape Education 1, 2, and 3 in a series of poems that are in the second book, The Window, where people talk about, I think this happened once, where we were in a meeting and a woman raised her hand and started asking questions. What if something's happened and what can the school do for testing and that kind of thing?
Mm-hmm.
And they said, and the person that running this said, has this happened to you? And she looked very calm and businesslike, and she said, yes, it has. But, oh,
wow.
I'm really sorry. If this is too rude of me, forgive me, but when did this happen to you? And I was guessing she was going to say something like 2 or 3 years ago with the tone of her voice, and she said 6 days ago.
Oh, wow.
And I thought, and all I could think was, oh, my God. That's going to hit her. I mean, someday it's just going to fall, and she's just going to lose it because that is a lot to have taken from you. And you can be all, you can be very well composed. And it was quite miraculous in the way she was talking about it and dealing with it so early on. But I just knew that something was going to hit in her and that she would have to deal with it more emotionally than she was right at that moment.
Yeah.
So yeah, my writing would be about things like that. And no, I'm not the woman that went up and said I was raped 6 days ago. But that's just, you know, these are the things that you write about.
Mm-hmm.
This is what you see around you because I put myself into that element to hear all of these things. So yeah, a lot of women's issues will come out. I don't try to make my work screaming women's issues. I don't think the key to believing is a screaming woman's issue at all.
No.
I mean, the lead character is a female. She's a female researcher, but she's a very hardworking kind of like, does she have a boyfriend? What's her issue? And she's just somebody that works, and you don't think about it. And so I don't think of that as a, you know, empowering woman or abuse to woman issue when I wrote that novel. But.
Mm-hmm. I'd like to remind everyone right now that you're listening to the Artist First Network. And this is the Author's First Show. I am Jade Logan, your host, and I'm interviewing Janet Kuipers, who has written many different poems, essays, a novel or two, and does lots of performance work in the Chicago area. We have one more track that we'd like to play of Janet doing some performance artistry. It's called A Retired Policeman...
A retired policeman talks about the suicides he's seen.
Yes.
This was done by a music act that did the music for this piece called Order from Chaos. It's off a CD called The Entropy Project. And I just read the piece. They said they were going to set music to it. And they ended up taking my voice and warping my voice and setting music to it as well. And I don't even know if it sounds like me. I think it's hysterical. So, but it's a good piece. I mean, it's a fun piece to listen to for a change of pace.
Odd for women. That's odd for women. Normally they take pills. Autopsy said she was full of barbiturates. She was a nurse. That explained how she knew how to do it. Thank you.
Welcome back, listeners. Janet would like to tell us more about her future projects, not only The Key to Believing, which she's already told us is with an agent and in the process of getting published, but the ones that she's planning beyond that.
Well, right now, because I've got so much writing under my belt, and people have asked me about this, I've worked on the idea of having a collection book done. Shortly after that accent that I mentioned before, I had realized I had a lot of things that were published only under pen names that if I had died, nobody would know what became of anything of my own. So I started compiling pieces together into what will hopefully within the next year be three collection books, one of poetry, one of prose, and one of art. The poetry in particular will have the best pieces of poetry from past books as well as material that is unpublished and really old, including that first poem that I read earlier tonight when I was 9.
Wow.
The prose book is a collection of things like live performances where I would talk things through, as well as short stories. It'll have a good part of the book Autumn Reason in it, as well as the stories about travel around the country called Change. And that one, I like the title for it. It's a Latin, Exaro Versus, which is a rough translation for found or written down verse. And the last book, which I think is really kind of novel to have because I've always wanted to do this, have an art book. Well, there will be lots of imagery in it, especially because of the fact that I've traveled through all 50 of the United States, through Canada and through a little bit of Mexico, and I've gone to 8 different European countries. Seeing the Swiss Alps, is going to Austria to see the Alps. It's excellent seeing the Eiffel Tower. There are amazing things that you can see while you're there as well. So trying to get a lot of these things, gorgeous churches in Europe versus in Chicago, which are quite gorgeous also, but still not as cool. It's a good way to be able to get imagery out to people as well as the written word. So
mm-hmm.
I'm working on those things now. My time's still spent right now designing books for people and working on the literary magazine, if you want to give the long name, Children, Churches, and Daddies. And running the websites for scars.tv that has everything from MP3 files from book shows and poetry readings alike, along with games and magazines and likes. I also do performance art shows in my spare time a lot now, including that show for tomorrow night at DVA Galleries, Chicago Tomorrow, where I'm doing a half hour or so long set of pieces called The Cycle of Life that'll have a lot of intriguing poems about birth, living through life, and death. So that's mostly the kind of material that I'm working on right now.
In your travels, do you have a particular place that you especially loved?
Somebody asked me that once, and there's one place that I love to go for just being able to have a place to relax and hang out, and that was along a certain mountainside in Golden, Colorado. Sounds really goofy. I think Buffalo Bill's grave is at the top of this mountain.
Mm-hmm.
But you just drive up to the side and just go over the side and curl around and just sit there. And it's absolutely gorgeous with being able to see mountains around you, but knowing that life is right down there, that you can drive down to friends, something that screams America or something like that.
Uh-huh.
There are beautiful places. I love New Orleans. I love being able to see the catacombs in New Orleans as well as hang out in the French Quarter. Seeing my family in Southwest Florida by the Everglades is also absolutely gorgeous. But I also like Chicago a lot because the architecture is phenomenal, and there's actually quite a bit to do and see while you're here.
What's your favorite place in Chicago?
Well, it's hard for me to even say because I like a lot of the places